This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Professor Stephen Salida about activities over the last year and his new teaching position.
Not only has the University of Illinois been pushed back in lawsuits, but now Stephen Salida is the Said Professor at the American University in Beirut. An incredible, wonderful comeback.
Dan Georgiakis joins us again to talk about the current economic crisis in Greece.
If you don't understand what's going on in Greece, you will after Dan's interview.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Smith and Michael Ratner, a bitter battle has been brewing between government intelligence officials and some of the nation's preeminent cryptographers and computer scientists.
I wonder what that could be. It couldn't have anything to do with encrypting our communications. I mean, I encrypt almost everything. I won't say hello without encrypting.
Well, Michael, I dare say that it's not out of the realm of possibility that that could be illegal at some point.
Yeah, PGP, Signal, well, all these things that
okay,
all my friends use.
This. An elite group of security technologists have concluded that the U.S. and British governments cannot demand special access, as they want, to encrypted communications without, get this, endangering the world's most confidential data and important infrastructure. The group issued a paper before a hearing that took place last week of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The government is seeking access to encrypted data, saying that they need that for cases like kidnapping, national security, terrorism. It's kind of like when they wanted access to hardware through the back doors. Now they want to be able to unencrypt encrypted data. But this group of brainiacs has said that it's probably impossible for them to do that in an accurate and safe way.
Accurate to do what?
The government wants to be able to unencrypt data that's now confidential and
right.
have access to it.
But of course, their excuse is complete BS, as
of
we
course.
Know from everything that WikiLeaks has put out. It's economic spying at its base. It's finding its political spying at its base. I mean, that's what's amazing is that the number of kidnapping software through this is probably zero. The amount of information they got on, you know, the economics in France, in Brazil, in Germany is very high. It's a way they get the U.S. gets an advantage in trade negotiations.
That's right. And giving the government a key to this data, as the New York Times noted, would require an extraordinary level of trust.
And we
can't trust the government.
And they could blackmail all of us, every one of us who's having extra, whatever we call them.
Right. Right.
God, that would be horrible
but
for us.
I want to read just a quote from the report. It said that should we give the government this access, such access will open doors through which criminals and malicious nation states can attack the very individuals law enforcement seeks to defend. This is the report. The cost would be substantial, the damage to innovation severe, and the consequences to economic growth hard to predict. The cost to the developed country's soft power and to our moral authority would also be considerable.
Well, I don't think there'd be any cost to our moral authority. We already have none
have
in
much.
The United States.
Right.
This is like a joke.
Yeah.
Everybody says that, but we have none. So in that sense, I don't think that the article or the report is accurate. We actually have none. Can you go lower than none? I guess you can go minus. So I guess that's where I'm on the way.
At the time we're recording this, we're actually recording it on the day that James Comey Jr., head of the FBI, and Sally Quillian Yates, the Deputy Attorney General at Justice, are testifying and urging the Senate Judiciary to allow such access.
I recall that years ago we went after James Comey on an ethics complaint, as I recall, for saying something about, it was one of their alleged terrorist people that they'd arrested, and even though they're not supposed to talk about cases, he talked about it in advance. That's just another thing about James Comey, but that's just probably one of a million. In any case, you know, what we see here is exactly the opposite, that in fact they're using this for economic spying. And I recommend people to go to the WikiLeaks.org website, and there you'll see just their revelations over the last 10 days, which were extraordinary. I'm just looking at them now. One's called All the Chancellor's Men. On just a few days ago, they published three NSA intercepts of Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, with a list of 56 national security targets in her office, including the confidential numbers for the chancellor and also her top officials, her aides, chief of staff, political office, and even their fax machines. So that's the kind of spying they're doing. Then there's another entry on July 4th, our wonderful Independence Day, when we celebrate our freedom. We're talking about what kind of freedom. They published on July 4th a top secret U.S. National Security Agency target list of 29 key Brazilian government phone numbers selected for intensive interception. Not only was the president, Rousseff, targeted, but her assistant, her secretary, her chief of staff, her palace office, and even the phone of her presidential jet. That's July 4th. July 1st, the Euro intercepts. NSA massively targeting phone numbers of top German ministers and public officials responsible, and here's what I was saying, for commerce, finance, economics, and agriculture, including her, including Merkel's personal assistant. And it goes on. The TISA releases. We've all heard of the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's part of a troika of three trade agreements, including one called TISA, a trade and services agreement. On July 1st also, they released a modern, what they call a modern journalistic holy grail, the secret core text for the world's largest trade deal in history, trade and services agreement. 52 nations comprise two-thirds of the global GDP. Releasing those secret documents. So that's what we're really talking about here when we talk about breaking encryption. Breaking encryption now is essentially the last resort for us right now of our privacy, our protections, etc. And the government wants to break it.
Michael, that was very interesting. I just want to add that the individuals who wrote the report criticizing the government's plans said that now these plans could affect the technology used to lock data from financial and medical institutions, and they could poke a hole in mobile devices and countless other critical systems that are moving rapidly online, including pipelines, nuclear facilities, and even the power grid.
Now, it's remarkable what they want to do with no embarrassment, it seems. A number of other WikiLeaks revelations that I wanted to mention took place in June. One that I love is called the Saudi cables. These are diplomatic cables from and to Saudi Arabia from all their embassies around the world. Apparently, there are 700,000 of them.
Wow.
And they've so far, WikiLeaks has released 70,000. I don't know when and if they're going to release the rest. But the main thing I think these early ones show is the number of people who are trying to beg the Saudi government for money, even though they come off as saying, we don't want anything to do with the Saudi government, but they want to get money from them. Including one of them says that the Saudis are willing to pay $10 billion to Egypt to free Mubarak back in those days. Mubarak doesn't seem to have any worries these days, but it's great because it's one of the first openings on what Saudi Arabia is really, really like. So let's hope we can beat back these efforts to stop to require the government to have our encryption keys. I think in the end, the hackers and other people out there, and I don't mean hackers in a negative way, I mean the coders, will be way ahead of the government.
Right.
That if they can decrypt one, there's going to be another they can't decrypt. I have a great confidence in the people out there who can protect our confidential communications, certainly much more than our own government.
Excellent. Agree. Michael, we have some rather astonishing developments in Ecuador.
You know, it's always interesting and disturbing to see the U.S. dirty hand in Central and South America. Of course, in the 50s, 60s, it was coup after coup, military dictatorship after military dictatorship. Of course, we saw a U.S.-sponsored coup in Venezuela that succeeded for about 24 hours, then failed. Again, the U.S. was involved. Now you see attempts by the U.S. to try and say Maduro is no good and to undercut Maduro, calling him a terrorist and other kinds of things. But they haven't left Ecuador out of their mix. Headlines of a couple of articles, U.S. orchestrated coup attempt in Ecuador. Another one, Ecuador fights for survival against its elites. A couple of things are going on here. Obviously, Ecuador is the place that gave Julian Assange asylum. That certainly would be, to me, one of the factors and the reasons the U.S. is going after Ecuador. But another one is, of course, the elites in Ecuador are very opposed to the Correa government. The Correa government wanted to, or announced, a higher inheritance and capital gains tax that affects about 2% of the population. Well, that 2%, which are the rich and the right wing, which control the media, the newspapers, etc., went completely crazy and are in the streets trying to, in different ways, destabilize and ultimately have that government overthrown. The article begins, one of the articles begins, it's by Stephen Lenman from a magazine called, a newspaper called Global Research, starts off, "Ecuador's in the eye of the storm." And then it refers to something that I don't really recall that well, Obama's earlier 2010 attempt to forcibly unseat popular President Correa failed. And then it says he's trying again. Ecuadorian democracy is being attacked. Since early June, U.S.-orchestrated right-wing protests, mainly in Quito and Guayaquil, have erupted, and they continue at times violently. So this is really just a way of giving our listeners a taste of a topic we're going to cover more in the future, but there is a major effort on board right now of the U.S. under Obama to destabilize the country of Ecuador.
Now, Michael, what could be the implications for Julian if this actually happened?
It's a good question, Heidi. Julian right now has asylum, you would think, and he's living in the Ecuador embassy in London. He's very protected there. The British can't go in. The Ecuadorian government has been extremely supportive of Julian. They've been trying to negotiate to get him safe passage to Ecuador from the UK at this point, or if he goes to Sweden, from Sweden. They have failed in doing that, despite the fact that a grant of asylum has to be recognized under law by both the UK and Sweden. They have not done so. But the answer to your question is, if a real right-wing government takes over in Ecuador, I can't imagine it will fare well for Julian. It will be contrary to law, because he has been given asylum, to kick him out of the embassy or move him out or turn him over to the British. But a right-wing government, particularly one where the strings are pulled by the puppeteer, the United States, it could go badly for Julian.
Since he's been given asylum by Ecuador, if something happened, could another country grant asylum? Does that ever happen?
Yes, it does happen, sure. In fact, in this case, initially the Justice Minister of France, after WikiLeaks' revelations about the spying in France said this is something we should consider, which is giving him asylum. So, yes.
Yeah, but Michael, what about getting him from out, the Ecuadorian embassy, right, into the French embassy?
Well, yeah, that's the problem all along, of, yep, course. That would be a serious problem.
Yep.
How do you do that? And, you know, would a diplomatic car flying a diplomatic flag have the ability to get him there? I would like to say yes, but of course the government of the UK will say no, most likely, and just grab him.
Is there any other situation comparable to this in history?
Well, there's situations where people have been in embassy for long periods of time.
Right, but I mean where then they've been sort of maybe...
To move from another to another embassy?
It,
I, yeah, don't think so.
Right.
I think this would be the first time. There's been people kept in embassies for 5, 10, 15 years sometimes. So let's hope there's no coup, not, yeah, just for Julian, but also for the Ecuadorian,
right,
people. I mean, some of the writings on what's been going on in Ecuador and what Correa's government has done for the people. One article, new airports, highways, hospitals, culture centers are everywhere. Cities with wide sidewalks, public parks are equipped with all sorts of playgrounds for children, public libraries, all kinds of buses, trolleys running on dedicated lines. Mm. Great emphasis on health, education, and culture. So the Correa government has been extraordinary for the people, mm-hmm, of Ecuador. When I was in Ecuador, I couldn't get over it. I went and I talked to a bunch of people who were like bartenders and things like that. And they said, yes, the wealthy are mad. But for us, wow, we now have actual real guaranteed ways of making a living, better schools, etc. So there's significant differences in the lives of the populations in Ecuador.
Yeah, we can never forget that the United States succeeded 3 years ago with the help of Hillary Clinton in overthrowing the Honduran government. They've been trying all along to overthrow the Venezuelan government. And, of course, they've been trying for years to overthrow the Cuban government. Never trust them.
Favorite hobby horse, Hillary Clinton. Yes, Michael, you brought out an important fact. She was basically refused to call it a coup in Honduras when it was clearly a coup, and essentially supported that regime change, which we're seeing the effects of today. And of course, recently, this last week, she came out with a letter to her major Israeli Jewish funder, whatever his name is.
A billionaire.
Major one.
Sabin?
Sabin, yeah, something like that.
And what'd she say?
And she said, please, I need help in how you can help us defeat BDS, the Boycott Divestment Sanctions.
No, I missed that.
Oh, my. Yeah. This is our Hillary. And, of course, as we've talked about many times in this program, she can never be forgiven for voting for the Second Iraq War, in which she did the vote for the worst possible reasons, not even because she believed they had weapons of mass destruction. There's no way anyone with any sanity could believe that. But because she thought it would help her, as warrior that she is, win the election. It made her go down, in fact. But this is a person who will bring us to war after war and coup after coup. Thank you, Hillary.
In what we can view as a major victory for supporters of Palestinian human rights, fired Professor Stephen Salida has been hired at the American University in Beirut in the American Studies Department. The American Association of University Professors called Stephen Salida's firing one of the most significant violations of academic freedom in this decade. Nationwide, over 5,000 academics pledged to boycott the university, resulting in the cancellation of dozens of scheduled talks and conferences at the University of Illinois. The University of Illinois' action was part of a broader campus crackdown on Palestinian human rights activism that threatens both the foundational role of the university as a place of critical thinking and debate and the ability to advocate for Palestinian rights. Professor Stephen Salida's gaining the job as the Edward Said Professor of American Studies at the American University in Beirut is a significant victory.
Stephen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
A year ago, the Israelis were massacring Gazans, 500-some children. You were tweeting angry tweets about it. You were about to move to the University of Illinois, where you had been given a tenured position in the American Indian Studies program. The Zionists went crazy. They pressured Chancellor Wise. She told you no longer had a job there. A year ago, you were out of luck. You had no home, you had no health insurance, you had no job. All you had was the potential for a movement in the United States that would support you and a lawsuit that might get you reinstated. And now we learned 2 weeks ago that you've been appointed the Edward Said Chair of the American Studies at the American University in Beirut. So you've gone from rags to riches. Can you give us a report back, please, on your current situation?
You know, my position was summarily terminated on August 1st of last year. And, you know, I was, like, you know, really on the brink of a move from Virginia to Illinois. So, like you say, we ended up really in a lurch. We didn't have any health insurance, no job, no income all of a sudden. So we moved in with my folks. And, you know, we eventually ended up filing a lawsuit because the University of Illinois hasn't been amenable to our reinstatement, which really has only been my my only consistent demand from the beginning, and a movement on behalf of academic freedom and, you know, solidarity with Palestinians, etc., indeed took hold, and it really carried me up to the moment that I found out that I'd had the new position at AUB.
Stephen, can you tell us what this means for you? When do you move? What do you teach? I presume you teach in Arabic. I mean, I don't know anything about this. So give us a sense of this and what the chair is like.
I think it came into existence about 7 or 8 years ago, and they're normally one-year visiting professorships, although I do believe that at least one prior Edward Said chair has renewed it for another year. It's in the Center for American Studies and Research at AUB, and I'll actually be teaching it sort of this semester I'm teaching an introductory American Studies course, and I'm also teaching a course on Indigenous theory. And the latter course on Indigenous theory is one that I had been scheduled to teach at the University of Illinois before they ended up firing me. So it's AUB is an old venerable institution in the Middle East. A lot of really fantastic scholars have gone through there. A lot of fantastic people have held the Said chair. So I'm remarkably honored, to get a position bearing the name of Edward Said and to be working in Lebanon and AUB particularly, which has a really, really vibrant cultural and intellectual life.
As you reflect back on all of what has happened over the past year, what sort of stands out as high points for you, obviously, in addition to getting this wonderful position?
The first thing that stands out is, and I guess it might have something to do with this conversation, but the tremendous amount of support and just love and friendship that I receive from Mr. Smith and Mr. Ratner and Helen Schiff and Sherry Wolf and other folks in and around New York City. They really put my voice out there, helped me raise money for the forthcoming lawsuit, all kinds of fantastic stuff. The other thing that stands out also is that nearly a year later, and I think this is kind of a culmination, more than a high point per se, the way that really the university's base of support has been reduced to folks who were deeply invested ideologically in Israel or in Zionism, that we've gotten to a point where people have been forced to sort of take account of Palestine in the way pro-Israel elements have used pro-Palestine narratives as an excuse to engage in various acts of repression or suppression. And I'm really happy to see that acknowledgement much more widespread seemingly today than it was a year ago.
We can't really go into much detail about the lawsuit, and we've had Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights on the show. But I understand that the university has already spent upward of $800,000. Do you have a comment on that?
Not much of one. I found out when the article came out, the newspaper article came out a day or two ago, and I was stunned. I think the tally at this moment was $843,000, and so it's a pretty significant amount. I guess I would just say it tells us what the powerful are willing to spend money on. They could use this money, nearly $1 million, to develop ethnic studies, to support Indigenous studies scholars, to honor contracts that they've signed with prospective faculty members. They could use it for student support. They could do all kinds of things with it. And instead they are spending it to ensure that their abrogation of democratic governance on campus, remains intact. And to me, that's remarkable, and that tells us pretty much all we need to know about today's corporate university. What are upper administrators willing to spend money on, and what are they willing to ignore?
Yeah, I was shocked, really. I didn't understand that public universities like the University of Illinois are really not public anymore. And it came out in the course of your lawsuit, they can't claim immunity as a public organization because 86% of the money that goes to the University of Illinois is private. And money talks, obviously. Look what they did to you. But I wanted to ask you, Stephen, about the support you got from the American Association of University Professors, American Studies Association, the Modern Language Association, 16 different departments at the University of Illinois, all came out in your support. Do you think that this had something to do with your able to land another job?
Yeah, I think it had a lot to do with it. Receiving support from such big scholarly associations, along with a handful of really well-known individual scholars, really undermined the narrative that the university wanted to put out there, that I'm an unrepentant anti-Semite, that I'm a terrible teacher, I'm too disrespectful to exist productively on a college campus. I think having the credibility and the imprimatur of so many of these groups, played a critical role in people understanding that this much of a consensus around a controversy in academe means that the story has to be, you know, a lot different than the official narrative we're hearing coming from the university.
A couple of questions. When do you actually start teaching in Beirut?
The contract begins August 15th, which is also when my UIUC contract was supposed to have begun. Classes begin September 2nd.
Well, this is all great. Let me ask a question about what you're teaching, because you said you're going to be teaching indigenous studies. And I know that, you know, normally when we think about it in the United States, and you were an expert on that, we think of Native Americans, and those are our indigenous people. And I know you, perhaps, and I think you have, drawn some parallels between the indigenous people of Palestine. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, we'll be looking at indigenous theorization and histories and politics in a comparative fashion. And so one of the places in the world that we'll look at, especially since, you know, we're existing just a few dozen miles north of it, is Palestine. And we look at Palestine in relation to places like Algeria, New Zealand, Australia, you know, the United States, Canada, and, you know, there are a lot of important parallels to draw, and primary among them, the fact that settlers in, Zionist settlers to Palestine and European settlers here to North America often conceptualize themselves as carrying out a particular biblical mandate. So there are a lot of similarities around notions of manifest destiny, and we'll look at the way that those narratives came into existence, and we'll also look even more closely at the way that a lot of indigenous peoples have recognized those narratives and analyzed them and worked against them.
Yeah, we interviewed Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz 6 months ago on her book, Genocide Against Native Americans, and she said that, you know, the main question really was take away their land. And you take away their land, you take away their culture. And I think there's a parallel there. Wouldn't you agree with what happened to the Palestinians?
That's absolutely correct. The first and foremost desire or priority among Zionist leaders was to get as much land as possible, not only for economic growth, but the more land, the more political power you have.
Stephen, I understand your new book, Uncivil Rights, Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom, is coming out early October.
Wow. I had no
That's
idea.
Right, October 6th. Yeah. Yeah,
Haymarket Books, Michael.
A busy next couple of months
right.
for you.
That Michael Smith was central in helping me find a publisher, an appropriate publisher for the book, and boy, he ended up being right. Haymarket has been an absolute delight to work with.
You know, you're, of course, one of the people who, in some way, as a hero, not only for what you did during the period of the Gaza War, but unfortunately for the consequences that were visited upon you. You really, more than most, suffered, I think, for standing up for your political rights. And can you just, I think you mentioned it, but can you just describe really what happened again when you lost that job?
It was panic and chaos. I had to move. We had to move immediately. We had to break a contract on a condo in Savoy, Illinois, which is just south of Champaign. We had to pack our things up and move in with my parents in Northern Virginia, you know, about 30 miles from Washington, D.C. You know, we just didn't know what to do. And academic jobs are extremely difficult to get, and, you know, they take sometimes over a year to go through the hiring process, so I knew that it would be at least a year before I worked in academe again. It was so late in the process that I couldn't even pick up a contract course, you know, as an adjunct. And, I don't know, you know, just dealing with tons and tons and tons of criticism and slander, and, you know, it was, I look back at you know, at those months particularly, and start to shake a little bit. At the time, you know, adrenaline was keeping us going, but now that things have settled down slightly, I look back at it as just a really difficult period for me and for my family.
I know it was, and what I was always admiring of was you never flinched in the face of it. I mean, they were putting everything they had on you, including your own personal circumstances. And you never, I mean, you just stood there as proudly and as strong as I think most of us have ever seen. So it's very special, and I'm glad about the job. I'm glad we're going to be able to interview you again when the new book comes out, and you'll already have taught for a month.
I absolutely cannot wait.
Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck in the next few weeks.
Oh, thank you all. It was an absolute joy. I really appreciate it.
And congratulations. A big hug of solidarity.
Thanks, Stephen.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The economic and political situation in Greece is in a tremendous state of flux. Will Greece leave the EU? Will its debt be written down and restructured? We speak today with Dan Georgiakis. Dan is the director of the Greek American Studies program at Queens College. He's a regular columnist for the National Herald, Greek America's largest newspaper, and he's the editor of the policy journal, the American Hellenic Association. Dan Georgiakis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleased to be here.
It's good to have you. The Greek people voted a week and a half ago by a large majority, almost 2-1, to reject the offer of the European bankers. And we wanted to start out by asking you, what are the ramifications for the people in Greece about this 2-1 vote?
Okay, I think we have to really see what the vote was about. About 5 years ago, the EU began making some of these loans attached to an economic program. And this economic program was designed to make Greece a better place to live. And what's happened since then is that corruption has increased. The economy has been shattered. Things like medicine and so forth are not available. Massive unemployment, 25% at least of unemployment, which is Great Depression levels in the United States, over 50% unemployment among youth. So the new package...
Wait, David, hold up for a second, Dan. I have a question on that because I'm not sure I understood it. First, you said there were loans made 5 years ago and they had some conditions, and then you said to make Greece a better place to live, and then you gave us consequences. You mentioned corruption, but I'm trying to understand what is meant by a better place to live from the point of view of the bankers, from the point of view of what did that mean to you?
Okay. The strategy of the loans was austerity, which they said would reinvigorate the Greek economy and therefore improve the standard of living of people in Greece, and of course would have good consequences for the lenders as well. So let's just take them at their word and say that this was genuine. But what happened, of course, was disastrous. Then this year with the...
Before you go there, I still would like to know about the austerity. What was the austerity package 5 years ago?
The major part of the austerity is to attack excesses of government. And as banks will, they somehow always think that somebody's pension is too generous rather than some corporate executive's pay is too high. So they slashed pensions, slashed minimum wage. They demanded that excess workers be cut from the bureaucracy, which included cleaning ladies in most of the government offices. So generally, you were going to correct the problems at the top by forcing rigorous austerity on those at the bottom.
Now, you did
say... I should point out that Greek workers have always paid their taxes because they have to, in the same way that American workers have to. And it's basically the professional class, the super rich, and the small businessmen who don't pay their taxes.
I want to go back again to 5 years. So 5 years ago, they gave these loans, which required austerity, and then you gave us some of the consequences as we look at Greece today. But I'm interested in why Greece needed the loans initially.
Well, Greece has always had problems with the economy. This was supposed to be part of the benefits of joining the EU, that you're part of a bigger, more vigorous economy. Think of a southern state in the United States, and you're being helped by the northern states in order to create a better dynamic for the entire units, for the combined units. I should point out, though, that these loans were, we speak about Greek corruption. The loans were corrupt by the lenders.
Yeah, exactly.
Goldman Sachs had a big hand in cooking the books to make the Greek economy fit EU regulations. Varoufakis, the finance minister, wrote a letter signed by many Greek economists to Brussels saying, look, these things are cooked. Brussels didn't pay any attention. Most of the so-called loans had a typical kind of imperialist aspect to it. We loan you the money, but you got to spend it in our country. Thus, Germany loans you X amount of dollars under the stipulation that you buy a German submarine. And the submarine has to be something the Greek Navy doesn't want. The EU gives the money to build the airport, but all the technology in the airport has to be imported from the other EU countries. So the net effect of this was to squash manufacturing in Greece. And you sort of had somebody, I'm going to loan you money to buy things from me, and you have to pay me interest to do it.
Siemens was a huge debtor, right? I mean, a huge loan.
Siemens was up to its neck in this kind of stuff. And it has already paid Greece millions of dollars in mistakes made. It said, "Oh, we didn't make nothing corrupt here, but we'll just do this to settle." So you can imagine how much profit they made. Now, the other part of the equation was that the two dominant parties, New Democracy and PASOK, were corrupt to the core, and a lot of the loans ended up somehow in their hands or in the hands of the party, and never really trickled down into the economy. You have things like both PASOK and New Democracy got huge loans for the party at interest-free from the National Bank, which got its money from the EU.
And those parties were, of course, turned out of office when Syriza won some months ago. And Syriza inherited this huge problem of a country really being sapped of its economic prosperity. So let's get up to the no vote of a week and a half ago, and what was at stake, and what did the Greek people do?
What the EU was saying was the mistake we made is we didn't have enough austerity, so we got to cut the pensions more. We got to have more austerity in Greece to really help you out. And that's the package they offered Greece, and Tsipras said this is impossible. Varoufakis said this is economic waterboarding.
Varoufakis was the finance minister, right?
Finance minister.
Until he resigned last week, right.
So they said this is absolutely unacceptable, but we have a mandate from the Greek people, and we're going to go back to the Greek people and find out if we still have that mandate. The referendum, you could vote yes, we're going to accept the EU proposals, or ohi, no, we're not going to accept these proposals, and one of two things can happen. One, you give us a better deal, or two, you may force us out of the EU zone, not the EU.
And so do you think that the huge vote against the European bankers gives the Greek Syriza government some leverage now?
That remains to be seen. Krugman has mentioned that this reminds him of 1914, in which everybody thinks they're really smart and things get out of control. The EU must make some concessions. There's no reason for the Greek government to make major concessions at this point. So it's really up to the bankers. And it is the bankers, it isn't the politicians.
Who are the bankers? Let's talk about that for a second. It's something called the Troika. Are those the bankers, and who are they?
Well, the Troika is the IMF, the German bank, Deutsche Bank, and other entities of that type. But in general, these are unelected people who decide whether or not they want to give this money. And let me just make a point that you hear a lot of, well, gee, wouldn't it be disastrous if Greece is forced out of the Eurozone? And in fact, people should be asking, wouldn't it be disastrous for the EU? Now, the EU claims that it's made these firewalls that the Greek pullout would not spread. But that's just wishful thinking, I think. I remember that in America, during our crisis, they said, well, we can sacrifice Lehman Brothers. Well, it turned out they couldn't. If Greece leaves the Eurozone, it means people can leave this entity, which they said people could not leave. Anybody who's loaning money to any country must immediately think of raising interest rates or withdrawing their funds. So what the contagion would be for the EU is really not clear. And it also means that the right-wing parties who want to leave the Eurozone, want to leave Europe, will say, look, they kick somebody out. Well, we can leave too. You see what happens. Now, the worst scenario for the EU would be if Greece goes out of the Eurozone and ends up thriving. And there's some possibilities for that.
If they went back and started their own currency, the drachma?
Greece doesn't do a lot of exporting, so therefore it doesn't have to borrow a lot of money, legitimate money, for business. Most of its products are agricultural and so forth, and they can do quite well with that. One of the major economic pluses in Greece is tourism. Now, if Greece goes to the drachma, and the economy, the prices will be so low, they'll be swamped with tourists. Last year, they had record tourism. If they use a drachma, and it's much, much cheaper than anywhere else in Europe, you can see that really thriving, and that money goes right to the grassroots because it goes to the taxi driver, the restaurant owner, all these people at the base. Secondly, there is Russian support possible. And that has a double aspect. One, Russia has been one of the great powers, has always been friendly to the Greek cause. And the U.S., which will be very worried about Russian influence, may have to come in and give some help to Greece in order to keep them from going to the Russian hands. So there's all kinds of things going on. China already has a big stake in the port of Piraeus. So the chances of the independent Greece, the first year or two probably be very hard, but it might end up thriving. So if an independent Greece, in terms of money, thrives, what does that say about the Eurozone?
I have a question, Dan, that we read a lot about in the papers. I know some of it was, you know, the right-wing propaganda's only interest now in what happens to poor people if Greece doesn't accept the terms of the Troika. But, you know, you see these pictures of people not being able to get their money out of the banks, ATMs running out of cash, not being able to buy food. I mean, the dire picture I have is dreadful for people in Greece, at least in the next period. I mean, what's your thought about that?
Well, it's true. It is dreadful. That's what makes the no vote so courageous, because in spite of all those things, people said, no, your program is going to make things worse. It's going to make things worse. Bad as it is, you're going to make things worse. And so it took a lot of courage to vote no. And I should point out that the Greek mass media is mainly owned by private parties. And they had a massive scare campaign, pulled out all the stops for a yes vote. And that failed. People also say, oh, you know, a lot of people didn't vote at all. Well, there was one segment of the Greek movement, mainly anarchist oriented, said, don't vote at all because we just want to get out of the EU. Just get out of the Eurozone. So renegotiating is not in our interest. So those people didn't even vote. So if those people had voted, they may have been 70 to 30.
Okay. Let me ask you another question about what's going on now. Because as we're speaking, and this will be broadcast next week, but the EU was given a deadline to Greece to come up with a proposal on last Sunday, as we're broadcasting, or this Sunday as we speak. That's one factor, and I'm interested in what's going to happen there. Secondly, there was the resignation of the finance minister, and at least the papers here put it out as, however you pronounce his name in Greek, which you'll do better than I will, he resigned in part because he was so abrasive with the EU bankers and that they wanted to put someone in there who was more palatable. So I have two questions. One about his resignation and what's going on there. Secondly, about what's going to happen on Sunday. Doesn't it seem that, Tsipras, that he seems to say we're not planning to pull out of the EU, we just want to make a better deal? So I just like your comments on those factors.
Yes, the last comment is very important. Greece has never, in these negotiations, said we want to leave the Eurozone. What they've been saying is you've got to deal with us in a reasonable manner, and you have to come up with a package that makes some sense. And you have to respect national governments that banks and central authorities cannot overrule democratic governments. Now, Varoufakis, the finance minister, who I happen to admire very greatly, is a very abrasive person. He says really tough things. He calls the bankers terrorists. And when he goes to a meeting, he doesn't do the usual diplomatic nice talk. And they say he lectures. What he does, he gives them the facts. And he says, these are the facts. They really despised him. So I was a bit surprised, but he withdrew in order to make negotiations easier and to take off this subjective factor. Now, the new finance minister has a less abrasive style, but he's been a member of Syriza for 10 years. I also like to point out that when Syriza came to power, it needed a coalition partner. And one of the things it did was take on a right-wing group as its partner. And people were tisking and thought, well, maybe they should have taken one of the social democratic parties. But what we see is if they had, the nationalists were strongly Ohi. If they had taken on the social democrats, those people would have cracked under the pressure and would have brought down the government because they wouldn't have gone along with the government. And in fact, one of the things that happened during the negotiations is the bankers actually called in the heads of some of the parties in Greece to discuss an alternative government. They were very open about wanting regime change. In fact, Goldman Sachs even said that publicly, well, we need regime change in order to make an agreement. So the fact that Syriza was very sharp in making its partners.
You use the term Ohi or something like that?
Ohi means no.
Okay, Ohi means no.
And let me point out, history. It was very clever the way they did that, because one of the great moments in Greece is Ohi, when Mussolini came in to invade Greece, and the Greek prime minister said, Ohi, and it's a big thing in Greece. So they framed the referendum that Ohi meant standing up for national independence.
Now, we're going to broadcast this after Sunday's supposedly drop-dead date by the EU. And this isn't the end of our interview by any means, but I'd like to hear what you think is going to happen when this is broadcast on Monday, looking in your crystal ball.
I know how good my crystal ball is. It's really up to the EU banks. Either they're going to have to find some face-saving device and really make some concessions, or it looks like Greece will be leaving the Eurozone.
Now, the concessions, I imagine, would be a write-down of the debt and that's happened before, say like in Argentina, and also restructuring of the debt, give them some years to pay it off so that their economy isn't so choked that it can't recover. So I imagine it would be something like that if they do it.
Exactly right, and Varoufakis has talked about that from the beginning, that that's what he wanted to do. He said, give us some time, you know, ease up the terms. We'll pay you back everything, but ease up the time payments, ease up some of these restrictions, and it'll work. And the banks have said, no, we're not going to ease up. So we're at that impasse. They just have to give in.
If they give in, you have what you could call the domino effect. What might happen? What is your projection?
I think that's the major reason why the concessions are not a foregone conclusion. The bankers have to decide whether they're willing to begin the end of the Eurozone's ethos because it's not worth the risk of making a concession. Because if you make a concession to Syriza, Podemos is going to soar in Spain and in Portugal, Italy, and in other countries. Groups like Syriza will be greatly strengthened. Even the right-wing groups, in some ways, will be strengthened. What are you going to do? Are you going to take a chance on the what you call the domino effect of democracy, or are you going to take a hard line and say, well, we'll take our chances with a restructured Eurozone?
Dan Georgiakis, you're well-known in the United States as being not only a Greek-American, but somebody that comes from Detroit. I'm thinking that really this has ramifications for right here in the United States, where we have a certain amount of austerity. And I'm thinking of Detroit, which has been a city that's been really reduced. What do you think the ramifications are for the United States?
I don't know if there's any immediate ramifications, the Greek, what happens in Greece, but the parallel with Detroit is very interesting because basically what you have in both cases is capitalist abandonment. And in both cases, you have a situation in which the center, the financial center, is taken care of, but the population is not. For instance, we hear now about Greece's Detroit. Downtown is booming, okay? Downtown is booming, supposedly, which it is. I mean, it is doing better. But there are 67,000 houses facing foreclosure. That's 10% of the population. And there's 40,000 people may have their water cut off because they can't pay their water bills. So what does that mean in terms of revived Detroit? And there was, therefore, you go back to Greece and you say, well, this austerity program, yeah, it'll help the Greek National Bank, perhaps, but will it really help the people? And the answer is no.
Exactly.
Another thing, I don't know if you've been following Thomas Piketty and some others. They've been writing about the fact that who is Germany to start lecturing people on debt when both after the First World War, but particularly after the Second, and in part because they wanted to encourage Germany to be strong against the Soviet Union, they forgave huge amounts of German debt. Are you familiar with that, Dan?
Yes, the big moment was in 1953 when they wiped out a lot of German debt.
And so what does that make you think about in terms of this situation?
Well, that's one of the points Greece has made. Greece has also made the point that Germany has never really paid for the damages it did to Greece in this vicious occupation of Greece. And among the things the Nazis did, for instance, was they forced the Greek government to make loans to the German government, and those have never been returned to Greece. That money has never been returned to Greece. And there are other things of that nature.
Right. So it is remarkable to me that Germany is on this high horse about countries paying their debts. I mean, I find
Yes, and I think that, well, yes. I should also point out that the banks in Greece right now are private institutions. And if Greece became free of the Eurozone, it probably would nationalize all the banks. And that would mean relooking at all the loans that have already been made and creating an institution that was directly controlled by the country rather than by outside financiers. That's interesting. Mass media is owned by oligarchs. Many of these oligarchs owe the Greek government a lot of money. So one could very easily say, well, get to pay up your debt and begin to change mass media, not by shutting anything down, but simply by saying, well, you got to pay your own way. Also, New Democracy, you may or may not remember, closed down public television about a year ago. Public television aired was the only outlet that systematically or regularly attacked and had independent views of the government. And one of the first things Syriza has done is bring ERT back. Again, as it was independent, it might very well give them more money and bring them back to a full voice, which would change the mass media climate in Greece.
One suggestion that Piketty has is a conference of all Europe's debts, like after World War II, and restructuring all debt, not just in Greece, but in the several European countries. That's Piketty's suggestion as a possible way around this. Think that's realistic? Any chance of it happening? And what do you think of that?
Well, I think it might be a good idea, but I don't think there's much chance of it happening. What they are talking about is, for instance, insuring deposits of banks. Like we have the FDIC in the United States. They're thinking of guaranteeing deposits in banks, which would be something they could do centrally. But otherwise, it seems the real problem is there is a prosperous North and there is a not-so-prosperous South. There is no legislative means to reach decisions. So everything is done at a technocratic level. And I just don't see how they're going to work that through. The EU is not known particularly for its efficiency.
And the last question, which you may not be able to answer yet, because it depends a bit on what deal is made, or if a deal is made at all. To the extent you had a magic wand, what would you prefer, Greek in or out of the Eurozone?
I think if Greece can get good terms, it's better off in the Eurozone. For lots of reasons. On the other hand, I don't think it's the end of the world or a disaster if they're expelled. I mean, I hope that doesn't sound wishy-washy.
No, it's very helpful, Dan. And this,
I mean, Greece, the Greek people generally, they always say we want to stay in the EU, which means they want to be able to have passports and go to different countries in the EU and the other kind of benefits that come from the EU. The Eurozone is slightly different, and you could there are countries in the EU who have parallel currencies.
England.
Greece could join that group.
Dan, I'll end with this quote, your last reaction, and we'll close this interview. Piketty says, quote, "Those who want to chase Greece out of the Eurozone today will end up on the trash heap of history," speaking of the Chancellor of Germany. Thoughts?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. It's Europe without the Acropolis.
That's a great way to end. But it'll be cheaper for me to go to see it. So they still have Sony Luminaire.
Great speaking with Dan Georgiakis, a true Greek patriot. Thanks, Dan, for being on Law and Disorder.
Ευχαριστώ.
That means what is
Thank
that?
You.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So long.
Bye, Dan.
Take care.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.